the show that's focused on investing strategies for today's needs and tomorrow's goals. This is Bucket Strategy Investing, presented by the Wealth Advisors at Lucia Capital Group. Now, here are Johnny Dean and Rick the Professor Plum.
That's right. Thanks for joining us. Man, oh man, it is time to get things rolling. It's going to be another busy hour or two. I'm Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, here again with me from Lucia Capital Group, our certified financial planner, ready to take your questions, to go over your options, and try to help you meet all of your retirement goals. That's our plan. Now, we're going to start things off with a couple of emails, actually, today. We're going to be taking some we haven't had a chance to get to. They've been sitting there for a little while. So I want to get those out of the way first, get those questions answered, make sure that you have all your answers to those questions. So we'll do that. And then we're going to have Steve Aldert. I'll tell you what he's talking about in just a bit. But at the bottom of the hour, we're going to have a little discussion on selling your home, an important topic to talk about. We're going to talk specifically about selling your primary residence, but we also may get into selling a non-primary residence, investment property, and things like that. Some different laws, some different rules apply, but you may not be aware that you could be in for some potential tax-free profits on the sale of your home. So we'll tell you all about it coming up here with Professor Plum in just a bit. Now, I mentioned Steve Aldort. He'll be in here in about 15 minutes, our loan financial planner. Steve's going to be in here to talk about the latest loan rates, and he's got a cautionary tale about wire fraud. Wire fraud in the escrow process. Look out for that. We'll also get into low down payment, conventional loans, and if we have time, the housing market in general. So a bunch of stuff to talk about coming up with both Steve Aldort and with our Brain Trust Professor Plum. You can give us a call with your money questions. If you want to do so now. 877-PLANNER, our number, PLANNER, or just head over to wealthed.com. That's our website. You can send us an email there at the Find Your Answer link near the top of the page. Professor Rick Plum joins me once again right now from Lucia Capital Group. I'll tell you this, you need a strategy. You need one that addresses each of your needs, your individual goals, one that aims to make sure your retirement goals are covered the first time. You can call our advisory team at Lucia Capital Group at this number, 800-644-1150. That's a bucket strategy. You need one of those, the Brain Trust Advisors will put one together for you. You can talk to any of them about your financial future and maybe give yourself a little bit of peace of mind. 800-644-1150, off the air. On the air, our number in studio, 877-PLANNER. PLANNER. So as I said, we're going to get to this selling your home topic at the bottom of the hour, but I've got a couple of emails that we need to get to here. Excuse me, Professor Plum. So if you want to email us once again at wealthed.com, John in Casa Grande, Arizona. I was 66 in April, wife 66 in October of 2016. At age 62, she started drawing $500 from Social Security. I plan to work until at least age 68. Do I file and suspend? That's a question. Does my wife have to be 66 to draw half of my Social Security? Otherwise, she draws a reduced benefit. Or do you have a better plan?
Well, a couple things come into play here. Do you file and suspend? Well, hopefully, you were the right age. You were 66 in April of this year. But if you did not suspend in April, filing and suspending now is not going to do much for you. It doesn't allow your spouse to take a benefit from your work record. So if you did file in April and you did suspend in April, the key wasn't the filing part, it was the suspending part. You had to have suspended it, which obviously meant you filed, in April or before, and then your spouse could be taking a benefit from you. But if you're looking now to suspend, it's not going to do any good. So rather than file and suspend, now you probably should be doing a restricted application from her. You'll pick up about, $400, $300 a month from her benefit. But if you file and suspended, that means you're not receiving a benefit and she doesn't get any enhanced benefit, because since you're suspending after April, there's nobody that can take a benefit from your work record, no current family member in the current household that can take a benefit from your work record if you've suspended your benefit. So when you suspend yours, you suspend anybody else's that's pulling from your work record. So right now, your only option is to take a spousal benefit from her work record. And that's a couple $100. If her benefit's 500, her full retirement age benefit would have been maybe 700-ish.
So 350, something like that. It's some money that you can have. I mean, it's not a ton of money, but it's at least something that you can do. Now, I guess, because apparently the goal with John is to wait until age 70 to take it, so... Yep. He's working until at least age 68, so I would say at least age 68, possibly 70.
Well, it depends. I mean, one of the things he hasn't really talked about, I don't think, is was there any longevity between the two of you? Because the reality is, if there's no longevity between the two of you, if neither one of you expects to live past the normal life expectancy, there's no reason to really wait to take your benefit. Just apply for your benefit. But if you think either you or she will live past what you would have been age 83, 84, then sure, waiting until age 70 of your benefit, getting the $300 a month, $333 a month now, makes some sense.
877-PLANNER, if you got some questions for us, 877-PLANNER, and emails at wealthed.com. This from Vincent in Alexandria, Virginia. I had a question regarding your excellent discussion of setting up a corporation. We talked about that last week. If I have a sole proprietorship and am considering setting up a corporation, is there a certain amount of business income I should realize before setting up a corporation even makes sense? Does income enter into the decision? That's from Vincent.
Income does enter the decision, but so does liability. And if you have liability stemming from some source other than you, other than your personal work, then a corporation may make sense even without a great deal of income. And so there's two reasons, as I mentioned. Income, now when your income gets higher, there are ways to help reduce one of the bigger taxes that a self-employed individual faces, which is the self-employment tax, the FICA that you pay as both employee and employer. And there are ways to potentially reduce that side of it depending on how much money you make. So there are reasons to look at it. Liability would be one, but again, you cannot protect yourself from you. So if you're the one doing the work, if everything stems off of what you are doing, you can't protect yourself from you. But if you have any employees, you said you were self-employed, but that doesn't necessarily mean you don't have employees. If you have employees, I would be looking to have some form of business entity to protect me from them. They have the best intentions, they're great workers, but every once in a while somebody might mess up. I mean, you could send them out to the store to go get something, some supplies or something, and if they get in an accident, they could potentially sue not only your business, but if you're a sole proprietor, you are your business, they could sue you for all your personal assets as well. If you're some form of limited liability company, LLC, or some form of a corporation, they can still sue the company because the individual is working on behalf of the company at the time of the accident, but they can't go after your personal assets because you weren't involved in it. And so there are liability reasons, but income will play a different role. So there's times when income is the reason you do it, and there's times when, even without much income, liability is the reason to do it.
Yeah, I've heard, too, folks, I guess on the radio, commercials, and you hear it a lot in Nevada, you know, incorporate your, you can completely save your, the message is you can completely save your business from any kind of liability. If you're not incorporated, you're completely open up to.
The ones I've been hearing lately are, they can't sue you. They can sue your business, but they can't sue you if you incorporate. So the terminology has
That's
gotten better.
Yeah.
The business assets are on the line. That's what insurance is for. That's why you want insurance. Because if somebody does, whether it's you or somebody else that does something wrong at the business and the liability stems from something that happened at the business, whoever is the person that got hurt will be suing the business. And everything that the business owns is on the table. Good insurance will help that tremendously. But if you are not involved in the negligent act, a corporation or an LLC can help shield you from that lawsuit. Now, if you're the one that did the work, no matter what the entity you have, you're going to get sued personally.
Yeah, there's the problem right there.
If I'm the one that created the negligent act, I'm the one that was driving down the street to go get supplies, I'm the one that issued the faulty engineering report, I'm the one that, you know, I'm the one that did the work, whatever the case. If I'm the surgeon and I'm the one that botched the surgery, it doesn't matter whether I'm in a LLC, an S corp, C corp, a big group, a medical, whatever. They're going to sue me personally and the business. With a sole proprietor, you don't have a corporation around you. You don't have a business entity around you. You are the business, and so you are on the hook for anything that happens. And your personal assets too are there to help support that business or anybody that comes after it.
Is there any reason somebody who's a sole proprietor should maybe not incorporate it? I mean, there are costs involved, obviously, for incorporation.
It goes back to, is there a liability protection issue?
Let's say no. I suppose any business could have some kind of liability if you really think about it.
Yeah, I mean, but there
right?
are, if that's the case, then there are some especially people that do side work. Maybe they have a daytime job. And they're starting up a business on the side, or they have a business on the side. They don't ever expect it to be really big, or maybe they do expect it to be big in the future. But at the moment, you're making $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000. But your day job, you're making $120,000+. In that respect, the individual probably would not want to be a full corporation whether it be a C or an S, but they may want to be an LLC, a single member LLC, to get the liability protection, but they don't want to incorporate, because if they do, then the business, you know, the only way to get money out of the business is either a dividend, which is not, you know, it's going to be taxable, but or salary to yourself. And if you pay salary, the corporation has to pay its FICA. You don't necessarily, as an employee, don't have to pay the FICA, because once you get to 118.5, you don't have to pay FICA. But the business still has to pay it, so you end up wasting money at the business level if you're a corporation. An LLC will get you around that, where they don't have to, you file as a sole proprietor at that respect.
Yeah,
but so you get the liability protection.
That's true. So cost, but liability protection at the same time. Okay, Professor Plum, we'll excuse him for this segment. Bring him back after the bottom of the hour. We've also got, we're going to be bringing in Steve Allendorn, our loan financial planner. Got a lot of things to say about markets and market trends and interest rates, wire fraud. It's all coming up here. 877-PLANNER, if you got money questions. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, the Brain Trust, coming back on Bucket Strategy Invest. We're rocking in the studio today, I tell you what.
About 10 notches on
this
the volume.
Is like, this is like a high school dance or something, you know?
Where's my beer?
Steve Allendorn joins me from Skyline Home Loan Mortgage Financials.
Somewhere close to that.
This Skyline. That's
there you go.
All it is. There it is. If you want to talk to Steve Allendorn, you can talk to him off the air at 888-563-1070, because we don't have time to take calls here. 888-563-1070, or just as easily at loan, L-O-A-N, financialplanner.com. All right. Very quickly, let's get the rates out of the way, Steve.
Broken record. They're
once
about
again.
The same. So it's been really nice. I mean, this has been a long run where rates have been really, really stable.
Yep.
Normally, we'll see little tick ups and then tick downs, but they've been hovering in this range for about 6, 7, 8 months. So with excellent credit, a good amount down, even on a refinance, mm-hmm. we're looking, you know, mid threes on the 30-year, 3.6, and we're talking about either with 0 points or minimal points. The 7-year loan, which we've talked about, at 3%, as low as 3%. 15-year loan, you can get in the twos, high twos.
Yeah.
Jumbo loans, 3.5, 3.6 on a 30.
Still the same as the conforming.
2.8, 3% on a 7. And government loans, between 3.25 and 3.5. But as we've talked, it's not always the lowest rate. Talking to you before the show.
Yes.
Doing a comparison with a borrower on a purchase, putting a little bit more than 20% down. They want to know, can I get 3.5%? They can, but 3.5% is going to cost them $4,300 in points.
Mm.
So when we start going through the scales between 3.5 and 3.8, at 3.5, they were paying $4,300 in points. At 3.6, they were paying about $1,500 in points. At 3.7, they were paying no points and getting $900 to help pay for their closing costs.
Oh.
And at 3.8, they were getting almost $3,000.
Back.
So when I did the comparison, the sweet spot was between 3.6 and 3.7, because we want to compare, what does it cost us to get that extra lower rate? How much are we going to save in interest? Divide those two together, and that gives mm-hmm. us our payback. And in the scenarios down at 3.5, they had a payback of between 60 and 70 months.
5 to 6
on
years.
All of those other loan options.
Yeah.
You know, if you really need the lower rate, the lower payment, because it's not, honestly, it wasn't that much of a difference in the payment either, then you go for the lower rate. But if you're looking for best cost and return, the possibility that if you spend a little bit less, if rates come down, you're in better position to refinance, it's not always best to choose the lowest rate.
No, and how long you're going to be in the home, too, plays a role there. You said the break even for this particular one was
5 to 6.
That's
not always how long you're in the home.
Or how long you're going to keep the mortgage.
How long, and you don't know.
You don't. I keep suspecting that interest rates will be higher 5 to 6 years from now. So my guess would be that somebody like that would probably keep the mortgage unless they're going to move.
Yeah. But, and so 3.5, 3.6, 3.7, depending upon the cash you have to close.
Yeah.
There's so many factors involved as far as how we design this. That's why it's important to deal with a loan professional.
Yeah, somebody's going to look and say, okay, yeah, I can get you 3.5, but they didn't tell you about this
$4,700
worth of closing
costs. Correct. Here's how it'll affect your closing costs. Here's how much cash you'll have left over. What do you want to do to the house after you're done? would you like to have this extra cash freed up so you can put in shutters, you can put in landscaping, you can put in the new range and stove? We got to look at everything so that you've got the whole picture.
Getting into the nitty gritty here. That's good. You got to do that, though. Okay, now, let's shift gears a little bit. You got a little wire fraud, not an alert, but what is it?
Well,
a
story. I think I had mentioned it, and it's something that's been in the news, that be careful of wire fraud, especially in mortgage transactions. So this is what happened to a buddy of mine in the business. Okay, he was doing a purchase. Right near the end of closing, his client got an email from the realtor, not from the escrow company, from the realtor, telling them where to send the wire, the routing number, the whole 10 yards. And what the borrower did was, okay, fine, set the wire up, and the money went to Russia. And
I'm not laughing,
there was $47,000 of the down payment and closing costs that ended up disappearing, and they lost the money. So, moral of the story and the red flags to be aware of. Whether you're doing a purchase or a refinance, if you're doing a refinance and you're bringing cash in, of course, with a purchase, you're always bringing cash in. Escrow will generally, and by the way, it wasn't the realtor's fault. Somebody hijacked the realtor's email account.
Right, so obviously the realtor had nothing to do with that.
No, correct. So escrow will have escrow instructions that will give their wire information. Normally on a purchase, you're going to wire in your earnest money deposit. So you want to be aware that, hey, this is where I wired it before.
Yeah.
The loan documents will have instructions. And the notary, if they're good, will tell you, here are the wire instructions. Here's where you should wire the money. But you should always follow it up with a phone call to escrow to verify that you're wiring the funds to this bank, to this routing number, to avoid giving your money to somebody else.
Yeah, see, I'm usually at the escrow office, or I'm with somebody when I'm doing that, you know, that kind of thing.
You haven't bought a house in a long time.
It's been, 1998.
Okay, it's been a long time.
So things have changed since then.
Yeah, I mean, there are certain states where you sit down at the table and you do all the sign-up.
In California, usually
what happens is escrow prepares the loan documents because we want to help the client out as far as ease. We have generally a mobile notary that will go to the client's home, do the sign up, go through the instructions, and then give them the instructions as far as where they need to wire the money. So it's not like it used to be where people would go down into escrow and go to the escrow office and sign the loan documents and get all of that stuff.
Oh.
Occasionally, but in most cases right now, everything is done outside of the escrow office, especially in California.
So what should this person have really been looking out for? This one.
Number one, not looking at an email from the realtor as far as where to wire the funds.
Or calling the realtor and saying, hey,
escrow is going to give you the instructions as far as where the funds need to go.
Now, how did this fake email person know that this person was purchasing a home? I mean, did they get lucky and send a thousand million emails out to people and just find somebody?
If I were to answer that, then no. I have absolutely no idea. I mean, people who are really smart as far as being able to find things out online, able to find out potentially property was in escrow, they dial in and you can look in the MLS and find the real estate agent contacts. Somehow they were able to manage to get into that real estate agent's account. Maybe what they did is they looked for an account to get into, a real estate agent's account.
And they looked to
see. And then looked and see what kind of transactions were going on and be able to see what was going on with their emails. Who the heck knows why and how they did it? They just got away with $47,000.
Well, and when you're wiring money, I mean, it's not like you can say, send it back. We didn't mean to do that. Once the money's passed, it's passed.
Yeah, I mean, if the money had sat in the account that where they wired it to, they may have been able to pull it out. But if somebody's trying to pull that kind of scam,
they're going to get
once the money hits, boom, that money's going to be taken out and moved somewhere else where nobody can touch it.
Check the routing numbers, make sure it's the actual bank, because that will tell you. If you want to talk to Steve Allidord about rates and buying and purchasing, refis and all that, give him a call. He's a loan financial planner, which I would suggest you, highly suggest you check out. 888-563-1070, 888-563-1070, or loanfinancialplanner.com.
And don't wire me any money.
Don't wire any money. Talk to him in person, all right? Steve, thanks very much. We'll talk to you next week.
Appreciate it.
Professor Rick Plum rejoins me when we come back on Bucket Strategy Investing. Welcome back to the program. It's Bucket Strategy Investing. Hey, we got room on the phones right now. So if you've got a money question of any kind, give us a call. 877-PLANNER, P-L-A-N-N-E-R. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum from Lucia Capital Group here talking to you. The Brain Trust answering your money questions, as we do every day on this particular program. So earlier in the hour, I mentioned this, and I want to get into this for just a little bit. Of course, you can call on any topic you want. Doesn't matter. But selling a home, and this has come up over the last, couple of days in various capacities, which is why I want to bring this up here. Selling your primary residence. First of all, I think a lot of people are aware that owning a primary residence, Professor Plum, has some tax advantages just in and of itself.
Well, sure. You get to deduct the interest.
Mm-hmm. Currently.
If you have a loan against it. Up to a value of $1 million loan balance.
Yes. After that, you cannot deduct.
$1.1 million if you stretch it a little bit.
Yeah, what was that extra $100,000?
Equity.
Okay, so if you have some,
if you have an equity loan, but everybody treats it that way anyway.
Yeah.
You can deduct the property taxes, which depending on the state you're in, that may be quite a lot.
We've heard of quite a lot, yeah.
And then you get to pay a lot for repairs and maintenance. But the idea is you've got to pay rent if you don't own, so hopefully you end up with an asset after paying over 20, 30 years, you end up with an asset that you can keep forever.
Yeah, and the nice thing is that as you pay your loan down, if you happen to be paying principal, you are hoping, and I would assume over the course of many years, that this investment that you've made, and it happens to be your primary residence, is also going up in value. So if you
That would be nice.
It would be nice. Now, you've never heard of this.
I have heard of it, just not lately.
It's been a long time. Some people. I mean, it's been, 10 years for you, right?
Yeah, I bought a house in 2005. Well, wonderful timing on that particular purchase.
Right. And so it still hasn't quite come back to the value that's...
Not what I paid for it. Nope.
Okay.
No,
all right.
No, sir.
Well, but anyway, it's come up from where the low it had been at. And in many cases, over 20, 30 years, I would assume that you're going to have some kind of gain in the home. Now, selling a home. This is really what we're going to be talking about here. There's a nice little tax benefit to selling a home if you have a decent amount of gain.
For anybody but me, anybody that has gain in their house, up to certain limits. If you sell a property, a primary residence, and you have a gain in that property, we used to be limited to, we had to always buy another property of equal or greater value, or there was this one time, you know, we could move down once we were 55 or older, and we could exclude 125 of the gain. That's all gone. That doesn't matter anymore. It doesn't have any bearings on today's sales. We have a primary residence. If we sell our primary residence, we can exclude up to $250,000 of the gain. So if I paid $200,000 for it, if I sell it for $450,000 or less, I don't have to pay tax on that gain. If I'm a married individual, or I have a partner in the home, we both can take $250,000 of gain and exempt it from taxation. So what is a primary residence? It's a property that I have lived in for at least 24 months of the past 60 months before sale. So they look at the date of sale and they go back. Did you live in it as your primary place of residence, not just a vacation home, for 24 months of the previous 60 months? Have you owned it for 24 months of the previous 60 months? I mean, basically 24 of the last 24 at least.
Yeah.
Now, the use and the ownership do not have to be concurrent. I could be renting a property for a couple of years and then buy it and move out and rent somewhere else, but I have lived in it for 24 months before I sell it, and I've owned it for 24 months before I sell it, even though they weren't at the same time. I can answer yes. Have you lived in it for 24 of the last 60 months? Yes. Have you owned it for at least 24 months? Yes. I can potentially exclude up to $250,000 of the gain on that mm-hmm. particular property. If I'm married, filing a joint return, $500,000. Or if I own it in partnership with somebody else, they can do it as well if they've lived in it as their primary residence.
Right. Now, by the way, 877-PLANNER, our number. If you have any questions on any of this stuff, 877-PLANNER. We're taking your calls here. It used to be, up until 1997, maybe 1998, that you had to buy up if you were under the age
equal
of 55.
Equal or greater.
You couldn't take your gain and walk away with it. You had to put
2 years.
2 years to purchase a home. You had to put your gain into a new primary residence. And if you didn't, you were taxed. It was a capital gains, I guess.
It was capital gain. But, right. You know, in those days, capital gains were about the same as ordinary income.
Yes. Now, in 1997, was it 97, 98?
May 7th, 1997, they passed this law that we have today.
Right. And so on May 7th of 1997, a lot of things changed, actually. A couple of nice things changed with regard to both owning rentals and all that stuff. They changed it. During the presidential campaign, Bob Dole suggested
the 96 presidential
presidential campaign. They had suggested that $250,000 of gain should be excluded
from the sale of a house.
Right.
Primary residence.
Yes. And Bill Clinton stepped in and said, well, that's a pretty good idea, except I'm going to go you one better. $250,000 per person.
Per owner, yes.
Right. So if you have two owners of a home, why is it per owner? Because
It kind of started off as two owners, but then when they looked at married couple, they just went with a married couple filing a joint return.
Right. So now instead of $250,000, he proposed a $500,000 exclusion.
To, yes.
And of course, at the time, homes were starting to come.
$500,000 was a huge number.
Well, it was a huge number, and so all of a sudden now you could sell a home that you've owned for all these years. You had $500,000 a gain. You could pretty much walk away with all of it without paying any taxes.
In most cases, you could. And you didn't require that you buy another property within a specified period of time. It didn't require you buy equal or greater. You didn't have to worry about the 125 limit if you moved down in value. It was just a one and done thing. I mean, you could sell it and be done. I mean, you take your exclusion, do whatever you want. That's it.
Well,
you could be a renter after that if you wanted to. It doesn't matter forever.
Yeah, this helped for a while, at least. This helped people who, say, had a bunch of rental properties.
For people that had a lot of rental properties and who could figure out how to, you know, to get their spouse, if they had one, to move every other year, they were, you know, we were talking about it for years. If we had five rentals, so we sell the property we're in today, our primary residence, use up to $500,000 of the exclusion to offset the gain, move into one of our previously investment property rentals, live in it, establish it as our primary residence, live in it for 2 years, 24 months, sell it, and move into another rental for 2 years, sell it. And as long as none of the sales were within 24 months of each other, I could exclude that $250,000 or $500,000 if I was married every time I did it. And that went along nicely for about 10 years. And then there was a lot of gain built up. Now, the one thing I could not recover, or I could not exclude, was any depreciation that I'd taken since the enactment of the law. But if I'd had a rental property from, you know, 1975, I'd depreciated it on the 22 years up until 1997. I only had to recapture the depreciation that I took after May 7th of 1997 when I sold it as a primary residence. So I got to avoid a bunch of recapture. I got to avoid a bunch of gain. Well, that was just too good to be true. And so they did crimp down on that a little bit. They changed the rules in 2008, and they said if you move into a primary residence that you have owned before it became your primary residence, and basically owned it for any reason, you've owned it for any amount of time as a vacation house, a personal resident, or personal property, you know, your parents lived in it, your kids lived in it, whatever. It wasn't your primary, whether it was investment property or not. It was. There's two classifications of property here. There is primary residence and anything else. So if it was not your primary residence and you owned it and then moved into it after the fact and established it as your primary residence, now there's a potential proration of the potential gain. And the way they look at how much of it is attributable to the primary residence time and how much of it of the gain is attributable to the non-primary residence time is they just look at the number of months that you owned it and the number of months that it was not your primary residence. But there's a caveat there. They only look at the number of months that it was not your primary residence after 2008. So if I've owned it since 1975, like I was talking about in the original issue, I've owned it for a long time. So my ownership is a very long time. So there's a lot of months of ownership. But only the months that it was not a primary residence after 2008 are going to count against me. And so this really affects people who were not owners as of 2008, who started off as investment, you know, property or non-primary residence property after 2008, and then moved into it for 2 years afterwards, because that the ratio there is not in your favor. But for some of these people that have owned it for a long time, the ratio is still very much in your favor. And depending on mm-hmm. where you owned it, you may still be able to exclude the entire $500,000 of gain if you have more than $500,000 of gain.
Yeah.
But they look at the number of months that it was not a primary residence after 2008 divided by the number of months of ownership. That resulting percentage is the percentage of the gain that cannot be excluded as a primary residence exclusion.
And it's the gain, not the exclusion.
In this instance, it's the gain that is separated. They don't reduce the exclusion of 250, 500. They reduce the amount of the gain. So some of your gain will be taxable.
Right. Okay, if you didn't follow that, that's fine. Give us a call. Ask us about it. Maybe you're selling a personal residence or you're thinking about buying one and you've got questions on how it could be taxed, what you could do with the money. You give us a call. 877-PLANNER is our number. PLANNER, 877-752-6637. Any and all money questions are welcome. We'll take some of your phone calls and emails. When we come back, this is Bucket Strategy Investing. Bucket Strategy Investing, Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, 877-PLANNER, PLANNER. I want to remind you, too, I haven't done this yet today, that besides this program on WealthEd.com, you can also find every Tuesday afternoon the Social Security Show. It's at 1 o'clock Pacific, 4 o'clock Eastern Time, and it's only available at WealthEd.com. So if you've got questions on Social Security, and just about everybody does, you can tune in at Wealth only at WealthEd.com. Get the answers to your questions. Send us an email there at WealthEd. We'll answer them on the program. And there's also a hotline you can call, which I'll give you now. But if you miss it, it's at WealthEd, 800-838-0483. Little answering machine. You can send us the question. Call the question in, and we'll answer it on the program. So tune in Tuesday afternoons, WealthEd.com, Social Security Show. All right, let's get to the calls. Tom, up next, Port St. Lucie, Florida. Hello, Tom.
Yes, as I've been listening to your program, I was discussing a potential option that I might consider if the law exists when I sell my house, is to sell the house and rent it back from the buyer while, say, I'm building a new house.
That's fine.
Okay, because, I mean, the house was built, or we moved in 2005, we've been there ever since.
Right, so you've been a primary resident since 2005. You're looking to sell it and then buy another house, but in the meantime, you're going to have a place to live, right?
Correct. So we'd rent the house, our own house that we sold to a new buyer.
You would rent somebody
a new house.
But the key is you're going to be renting somebody else's house. You're not renting the house from yourself. You're renting it from a completely.
Well, I understand. House, but just a different owner.
Yeah, it's a complete change of title. The thing is, they're not required to rent it to you. I mean, you can put it in, but...
No, I would work that out ahead of time.
Yeah, but, it's fine. You actually sold the property. You're not selling it for less than market value or anything like that, or more than market value, so you can live in it for the next several months while the new house... You're just selling it and then renting it back. It's fine.
Yeah, well, what we would probably do is an arrangement where we'd sell the house at fair market value mm-hmm. with the understanding that we would rent it until our new house was done.
Right. I mean, as long as everything's, above board, fine. You're not selling it to your wife, who you're going to try to do. But it doesn't matter. Even if you, didn't rent it back. Let's say they postponed it and said you were actually living in it at your own house and the transfer didn't happen for 6 months. Doesn't matter. You still sold your house. You've lived in it for 24 months. You've owned it for 24 months. It's still going to be qualify for the gain. It's not an issue.
Yeah. Okay, just that's assuming the law doesn't change in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I think you're probably okay.
I don't see him doing that.
Yeah.
Well, I hope not, but I mean, that just gives us an option.
It sure does, yeah.
It's a smaller house.
You just happen to be the renters. That's
You just have to move once when you get the new house done. I bought my house in 2005, we sold our old house much quicker than we expected, And we had to find a place to live while the new house was being built. And we had 3 months of living in a very small condo.
Well, we sort of did the opposite. We planned to move to our new house. And we owned two houses for a period of time. It took longer to sell it than we expected.
And I wanted to avoid that.
And it took 2 years to build the house.
Yeah.
So that was a challenge because we only moved like 2 miles away from our old house.
Well, you're okay, Tom, no matter how you look at it.
Okay, just thought I'd get a clarification. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. I'm glad you did. That's why we're here. We'll clarify for you.
Yeah, I wanted to avoid maintaining two mortgages, one on the new house, one on the previous house. So I put it up for sale, you know, 4 months ahead of when we wanted to do it, before the new house was going to be done. It sold like on the second day, third day, for more than we were asking.
Hot real estate
back
market,
in 2005.
Should have been a clue.
Well, and it wasn't a choice. We inherited a nephew and we had to buy a bigger house.
I get it. But you had that condo for 3 months.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. We went from a house that was too small to a condo that was smaller.
Well, you know what? If you'd known then what you know now. All right, let's get another call. 877-PLANNER Joe, somewhere in New York. Hello, Joe.
Hi, guys. Love your show. Long-time listener.
Thank you.
Question in reference to the executor's fee on an estate. Where does that percentage get calculated from?
Well, generally on the gross estate.
So would non-probatable accounts be included in that?
Very well. I mean, if you've got a trust, that trust doesn't go through a probate, but there's still a lot of work for that particular trustee of the estate to deal with. So you're dealing with assets. Okay, obviously, if I've got life insurance, I don't charge a fee if there's a named beneficiary and the beneficiary does all the work to get the money transferred over to them. Same thing with an IRA. If there's a named IRA, you know, maybe I charge a fee to organize the estate and to notify all the different beneficiaries of what they are potentially and what their jobs are at that point. But if 100% of the money is in an IRA and it's going to two people, myself and another person, I'm really not going to charge the estate very much to do anything with that because there's nothing that the executor has to do in that respect. But if there's a lot of assets, I'm dealing with a lot of different, beneficiaries, then now it's a sliding scale on how much I charge. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it has to go through probate to be part of the estate that the executor is dealing with. I mean, there's some times where dealing, even with the smaller estate, dealing with the beneficiaries is a giant pain, and you deserve a medal as much as anything else.
A little compensation, you're saying? Yeah.
So does the, because the state that we're looking at, it says up to 5% for the executor's fee, and there are some joint accounts with the deceased that's not part of the probate process, does that value count as that percentage towards the executor's fee?
If it's joint tenancy with rights of survivorship, I would say probably not, because the executor has nothing to do with that asset. The executor, nothing the executor does is going to change what's happening with that. So the joint tenant with rights of survivorship, the surviving tenant there, has everything to do with that. So the executor doesn't even deal with that.
And what if there's a piece of property that has, it's worth $300,000, but it's got a mortgage that's worth $300,000. So is there a percentage based on the $300,000, even though that $300,000 isn't going to be distributed amongst the beneficiaries?
There's probably a list at the state level. Contact the bar association there, contact some attorneys, because that's a tough one, because if I've got a property that's worth $300,000, and it's underwater or something, it may be that you just contact the debt holder and say, it's yours, and be done with it. And so there's a lot going on here that you need to have more than what I'm telling you as far as how much you charge.
Joe, if you ask more questions, hang on. We can talk to you just a minute or so. I just have to take a break for the news. We can talk to you during the news if you need some more help with this. So don't go away if you have more questions. If you need the brain trust off the air, you can talk to Professor Plummer, any of the Lucia Capital Group advisors, 800-644-1150, their off-air number. This is Bucket Strategy Investing. Another hour is just ahead.
Information presented should not be considered specific tax, legal, or investment advice. You should always seek counsel of the appropriate advisor prior to making any investment decision. All investments are subject to risk, including the loss of principal. There is no guarantee that any investing or financial planning strategy will be profitable, provide protection from loss, or meet its stated objectives. Investment advisor representatives of Lucia Capital Group are also registered representatives of and offer securities through Lucia Securities, LLC, a registered broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. John Dean is an associated person with Lucia Securities, LLC. In the information presented, the opinions and views expressed are subject to change without notice and may not come to pass. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of skill or training.